All opinions expressed on this podcast are solely the individual's opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis of investment decisions.
The vast majority of people in the space are following a get-rich-quick scheme. Most of them don't know what Bitcoin is. Most of them haven't the foggiest clue what the underlying technology does. Most of them just know at some point, if you had bought Bitcoin, whatever that means, it went up in value by a lot and you'd have gotten rich. And I think that's getting into it for the wrong reasons.
Welcome to the Internet 3.0, a podcast exploring the past, present, and future of the web, with the leaders busy building it. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Maneeb Ali, co-founder of Blockstack, and we had the pleasure of talking with Bram Cohen. Bram learned to code at the age of 6, and he hasn't stopped since. He's a pioneer of peer-to-peer technology and created the popular file-sharing protocol, BitTorrent. He's since turned his attention to the world of crypto, and specifically, Bitcoin. And if you couldn't tell from the opening clip, he's got some strong opinions on it.
So all the stuff that I've been doing in the publicly in the Bitcoin space has involved shitting on things. My presentation right now is on, well, shitting on cryptocurrencies generally. Specifically, I'm going to be talking about removing the waste from cryptocurrencies.
That was from a talk Bram gave in 2015, but he's no longer just a critic. Now Bram is focused on building a better Bitcoin with his new startup, Chia. We'll get into what Bram's concerns about Bitcoin are and what he's doing differently with Chia. But first, let's explore some of the things that have shaped him as a technologist.
I don't get to talk to a lot of people who started learning how to code at 6. That just feels like a fun fact. Maybe starting at the beginning.
My dad taught me to program when I was very young. And I'm actually pretty old to have learned how to code at 6. That was not a common thing when I was a kid. Computers were much less common than they are today. And this was like the ancient days. I mean, this is back when you'd get like a Computes Gazette and they'd have like physical magazine. And they had printouts of programs that you would then go type in on your computer to run them locally. As if this was a reasonable thing to do. And, you know, I was a kid, so I wasn't that great at programming at 6. I kind of was okay at programming when I was like 12. I wrote a program to play Connect 4, and it did alpha beta pruning. And then I was kind of, you know, actually very good at algorithms and stuff like that. Right after high school, I got an internship at Bell Labs over the summer because I'd been working on stochastic algorithms to solve three colorability problems just for fun, just because I found this an interesting problem to mess around with. And by stochastic, I mean you have a problem, and rather than guaranteed exhaustively looking for a solution, it just kind of comes up with an approximation of a solution and messes with it until it happens to come across a solution, and it tries to be as good as possible at messing with it so that it will likely come across a solution as quickly as possible. This at the time was considered artificial intelligence. It's since gotten fired from being artificial intelligence because in general, whenever something starts actually being real, it gets fired from being artificial intelligence and turns into like search or routing or logistics or whatever it's known as afterwards.
And when was the first time you experienced the internet?
Oh, I first got on the internet in 1993 when I started going to college. The internet as we know it today didn't really exist back then. It was like, it was Usenet, and to a lesser extent, it was, you know, mailing lists. Usenet today is dead as a doornail. May it rest in peace. It turns out when you have a thing that anyone can post to completely unimpeded, it gets overrun by jerks. I remember the first spam campaigns that ever happened. I remember spam becoming the term of art that people used for them. Like, it was just a notable thing when someone conducted a spam campaign back then. Not a very welcome one, but not the, oh, this again kind of thing that it is today. People talked about the September which never ended because there was this like ongoing cycle that every year there would be some noobs on the internet in September because they were the people who just got into school and had never been on the internet before. And they kind of behaved like people who were new to the internet And then after a few months stopped behaving like jerks, and the internet became a much nicer place afterwards. And September 93 was the one where the internet was really taking off. And people called it the September which never ended. There was never again after that an era where the internet wasn't overrun by jerks. Due to too many people being on it.
How would you define the internet? And what would you say its role is in our lives, individually and sort of societally?
Well, you have this consolidation of communications technologies, right? So in the past, there were a multiplicity of them. There was the postal service and telegrams and phones and television and cable and radio and SMS. And these are kind of, you know, slowly... Oh, and newspapers and books. And, you know, these are all these different technologies and media for communicating information. And what we see now is this one technology that's just swallowing everything else. And it's just the end of the line. There are going to be no new communications technologies. Everything we do in communication is going to be over IP. Hmm. And I don't think that's going to change in the future.
Wild.
And it's made... And it's made like a fundamentally different world. There was this story of a dad, I guess was a bit older than me, spoke to his kid and who was 10 years old and told him, you know, when I was your age, there weren't any computers. And the kid thought about it. And he's like, really? And I said, yeah. Kid was like, well, how did people use Wikipedia before there were any computers?
That's good.
But I, you know, hung out on Usenet news groups, which were ridiculous. I mean, they were a lot like Reddit is today. I mean, the same, like Reddit with Reddit with a lot less policing. So you can imagine what that was like. Maybe less professional trolls than Reddit has. So maybe not all worse.
Eventually, Bram dropped out of college. In his words,
because it sucked.
A few crappy jobs later, he started asking around for advice for where he could move within the U.S., where he wouldn't need a car, and could find work as a programmer.
And everybody told me, oh, you should move to San Francisco. I mean, this sounds like even a silly question to ask today, because everyone knows that, but it wasn't as common knowledge at the time.
But before he could get settled in, he needed a job and a place to live.
Someone told me, oh, go to cnewmark.com, there's a mailing list. And I did, in fact, find a job and a place to live off of it. That was this service, it was run by this guy named Craig Newmark. It was named after him. I think it's grown a bit since then as a service.
Yeah. You don't say.
You might recognize it by its current name, Craigslist.
After that, I worked at a bunch of startups you've never heard of, because when you're a college dropout who's a good hacker, that's what you do. Well, the most notable one being was Mojo Nation. So Mojo Nation was supposed to be the all-singing, all-dancing cypherpunk project. And it was really great fun to work on and great experience, but it kind of collapsed under its own weight, trying to do too many things at once without a, you know, clear, focused product vision. There wasn't really much salvageable in terms of the code there, but I had, you know, some valuable work experience. So I decided to do a project that was much more focused. So I wrote just a little utility, although it took me a year and a half to get working reasonably. But I decided to write basically just a utility that did nothing but a swarming distribution, that did file distribution where peers who were downloading it were uploading to each other while they were downloading. I did that, and that was called BitTorrent. And that got a decent amount of usage reasonably quickly.
He's being very modest here. Bram started working on it in 2001, and it only took a couple of years for BitTorrent to really take off. And by really take off, I mean that by 2004, a British web analysis firm, CacheLogic, reported that it accounted for 35% of all the traffic on the internet. That was more than all other peer-to-peer programs at the time combined. As a successor to Napster and other similar file-sharing applications, BitTorrent wasn't universally loved. It even came to be hated by the entertainment industry. But it's clear Bram was never interested in piracy. It seems his focus was squarely on technical possibilities.
Well, as an inventor, I love inventing. And your toolbox as an inventor is in some sense kind of limited. All you can do as an inventor is make stuff work better, right? As a politician, you can set policy. You can go change things. As an inventor, all you can really do is say, I'm going to build this thing. I'm going to build a better mousetrap. You can't say, I'm going to build a mousetrap that's more purple or more righteous or, you know, likes bigger or smaller mice or anything like that. I'm going to make a better mousetrap. And that's the only tool you have. So that's the thing that I have in my toolbox. I can decide what kinds of technology I try to make better. But fundamentally, if I'm not making some technology better, I'm not accomplishing anything.
So I guess I'm curious how you move from creating one of the most used protocols online to sort of shifting your focus onto crypto networks and your work now with Chia.
Well, I'd been looking into cryptocurrencies for some time. At first, I'd mostly heard about them for this like asset bubble that everyone was super excited about. Now, I don't get excited about asset bubbles. It's like, you know, been there, done that. I don't consider is not what I'm about. But eventually, some friends of mine were like, you know, Bram, there actually is something really interesting in Bitcoin. You should look into it. Like, there's some really interesting tech there that's worth studying. I'm like, oh, okay. So eventually I got on Bitcoin Wizards and had many more like involved discussions with people about it. And, you know, would get these links from people. Something would come up in discussion. I'm like, what are you talking about here? And people would send me a link. I'm like, so I'd have this like list of things to read that was like very extensive. And I would spend, you know, there were periods of time where this is what just what I did all day long was read up on cryptocurrency stuff. Eventually I had a good idea of what was going on. I understood how Bitcoin worked pretty well. At the time, there were really no good write-ups of it. These days, there are a lot more people who understand what Bitcoin really is and does. Eventually, it just kind of seemed that, like the time was right. I had some general ideas about what I wanted to accomplish, and it seemed like the tech could make it, and things were kind of under control at BitTorrent. So last summer, I left BitTorrent, and me and Ryan founded Chia.
Just to clarify, by last summer, Bram means summer 2017. Since then, he and his co-founder, Ryan Singer, have already gotten a lot of attention for Chia. But like lots of things in the crypto space, attention doesn't always come with understanding.
There was just this article that said them trying to kill Bitcoin. It's like, I hate it when headline writers put words in my mouth. I didn't say that. I'm not that aggro. But I'm trying to build a better Bitcoin and outcompete it on technical merits. Now, in the current market, there are, shall we say, relative valuations of different cryptocurrencies that are not reflective of their relative technical merits. So there's not that much sanity in the market right now. There's going to have to be some pain before things start getting evaluated on their technical merits. The core idea is let's do proofs of space. And then there are these supporting ideas around that.
But before we get into those ideas and why they matter, let's get clear about what Bram does like about Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is a secure distributed database. For a long time, it was thought to be impossible to have a secure distributed database. It can be mutable. It can have data that can be changed, and it can be secure, and it can be distributed, right? And the thinking for a long time is you can only do two out of the three. Some anonymous hacker who went by Satoshi Nakamoto came up with a really core idea. We're going to have a secure distributed database. And to do this, we're going to need a consensus algorithm. You and I are going to be talking to each other, and we need some way in which the two of us are going to come to agreement about what the current state of the database is. And to do this, we're going to use a blockchain. Contrary to popular belief, blockchain is a real word that has real meaning. It's not just some buzzword. This business of pretending that everything that has a secure hash-based history is a blockchain is just dumb. Like, no, Git histories are not blockchains, okay? That's a concept that goes way back. So when you have a Bitcoin history, it has weight. There's some amount of difficulty involved in calculating that particular blockchain history, that you must have blown approximately a certain amount of computational resources generating it. And if you and I get into an argument about what the current state of the database is, the way we resolve this is we compare our histories, and whoever's history weighs more wins, and the other person just reverts to their history. And very rapidly, everyone comes to consensus.
In case you're wondering if there's more to it, the answer is yes. But Bitcoin is so new and the tech is so complex that there's still some mysteries, even for the experts.
Some of the subtle details aren't written up in the literature anywhere to this day. Significant evidence, there's certain things Satoshi figured out and never explained and just did the right thing in terms of how blockchain history works. But that's getting kind of deep in the technical weeds there.
So what's the catch? In a word, energy. In the words of Laura Nering, sustainability leader at 3M's Electronic and Energy Business Group,
a crazy thing to think about with respect to Bitcoin, depending on which estimate you look at, is it's expected that Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining will require to use as much energy in 2020 as we use today in the whole world for everything.
While that figure has been contested, what can't be denied is that Bitcoin is fundamentally power hungry. In August of last year, it's estimated that Bitcoin mining required almost 1% of the world's power. That's more than it takes to power New York State. It comes down to the proof of work algorithm behind Bitcoin mining, the very thing that enables the Bitcoin network to be a secure, distributed, and mutable database. How does it work? Well, it's complicated, but all you need to know is it involves a lot of computers solving very long and very complicated math problems. And those computers require a lot of processing power and energy.
That's just inherently what Bitcoin does. It must be occupying a resource, and every resource you do, the fundamental limiting factor is going to be electricity.
And this isn't just true for Bitcoin. It also goes for Ethereum, Zcash, Monero, every major cryptocurrency available. So what's different about Chia? Well, instead of using proof of work, Bram and his team have been working to invent a new, greener, and potentially more secure solution. Proof of space. I'll turn it over to Bram for an explanation.
In very broad terms, I can explain what proofs of space are. So the core insight here is you can't get away from expending some resource. Almost always when you're expending resources in general, this is going to boil down to making some kind of hardware and using electricity. And there's a question of, well, what could we do? What else is there? What could we make? And there aren't very many fundamental properties of the universe to select from here. There's basically only one that really seems to fit the bill if you thread the needle really, really carefully, which is space. This is storage capacity. Economically, it has this really nice property that people are already wasting ridiculous quantities of it. There's some huge budget for people spend buying storage capacity all the time, and a very large fraction of that is sitting around unutilized. And it also has this nice property that there's no special memory. Like, bits are bits, or special storage space, rather. Memory and disk are different. But if you make it so you can use disk, then bits are bits. Whatever property you want out of storage has already long since been optimized for, because it is the thing that hard drives do. So if you could somehow find some algorithm for proof of work that is Nakamoto consensus, that's still following this fundamental idea that you have a blockchain history that has weight, but the bottleneck in generating it is the amount of storage capacity you're allocating to it, and the amount of electricity you're allocating to this is completely nominal. This kind of fits the bill. Then what should happen from a market standpoint is all these people who already have ridiculous amounts of extra storage capacity will just go ahead and do this and get some gravy money with it. And no one's really making it, no one's really acquiring any new storage capacity for this. And anyone who goes, oh, I'll invest in this, is going to wind up losing money on it because they're paying full price for it to do nothing but, we're calling it farming instead of mining, to do nothing but farming off of it. And the equilibrium price will be considerably lower than the purchase price because there's already way, way more than the total amount of rewards that are being handed out that are being measured in dollars that are being allocated towards this farming process, just because people had it sitting around and are using the value of those things for just this gravy money they get off of it.
Yeah, so you're designing this in a way that if you want to be a professional farmer, you are going to lose money. But if you have some spare resources available, that's the only way to really participate in the netbook and make a profit.
You can participate if you want. You can buy stuff to participate if you want. You'll just be doing it at a loss. So people are not likely to do that all that much. Although, you know, most people on their personal computer have like ridiculous amounts of unused storage capacity. Utilization of personal computer hard drives is quite low in general. And you'll be able to get some amount of rewards off of that. The benefits to this are twofold. Number one, it's much more green. You're not wasting stuff to it. And number two, it's much more distributed. If people are doing investment in order to mine, then what winds up happening is whoever gets the best ROI winds up doing most of the mining, and you kind of get this oligopoly of just a handful of miners like you see in Bitcoin. Because this is using just the spare stuff that's sitting around, this is already very widely distributed resources that are staying very widely distributed. Not completely evenly distributed, but much, much better than the situation looks like in Bitcoin. And since in Bitcoin the whole point is it's supposed to be a secure distributed database, this is a really good property for it to have, is for it to be more distributed. And it makes it much, much less likely that anyone's going to attack the system.
At this point, you may be wondering why Bram would want to go through all this trouble. Talking to Bram, it's very clear he's passionate about social change. Listen to how he opened a 2015 talk to Bitcoin developers as he was getting more involved in the space.
Before I give my talk, I'm going to read a poem. You are in the wrong place. You aren't going to find what you came for. You might as well go home. You aren't going to get rich here because the revolution will not be monetized. The revolution will not...
I'm not going to play you the full three-minute poem, although I highly recommend clicking the link in the description to the full version. Here's how it ends.
Will not be monetized. The revolution will not make you rich because the revolution will be free. Yeah.
What would you say you mean when you say the revolution will not be monetized?
Well, first there's the obvious thing that it's based off the poem, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And you get this usurpation of movements. You get these mass movements that mean, I don't know what they mean. They mean something, that they're about something. They have a cause. And people come in and they're like, wow, this is something that people really care about, that's exciting, that's going somewhere, that's making something happen. I can use all this momentum to make money off of it. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's either a cheapening, an undermining, an exploitation of like fundamentally what the whole thing is about. And to me, Bitcoin is exciting. It's like this new technology. It enables this new thing. And I have these goals with it that, you know, the finance industry kind of sucks, right? Like, yeah. An awful lot. It would have been a very natural life path for me. Like, I went to high school in Manhattan. I was on math team at Stuyvesant. It would have been a very nice life path for me to actually bother studying when I was in high school, go to Harvard, come back and get an extraordinarily high-paying job on Wall Street. And I would most likely have a lot more liquid cash in my pocket today had I done that than had I done what I actually did. But I'm not about that. I don't care about that. It's not interesting to me to try and write something that day trades like a tenth of a percent better than what anybody else came up with and take all the money. I want to build something that creates value, that does something real. And there are real things that the finance industry does. They like move funds from point A to point B. Right? That is fundamentally what they do. And they do a really bad job about that. Wire transfers are these ridiculously sketchy things. It's like, wait a minute, why do I have to enter in the address of the target bank? Why is there not like a central database of all the banks in the United States and what their addresses are? There are what, like a few thousand of these? How hard is it to have someone's job be to keep track of that? Why do I have to enter this and get it right? And why do you have to call them and validate what is going on here? There are good and bad reasons for this. The good reason is that when you have banks that are just unfettered, that are just allowed to do whatever they want, they decide that their job is to obfuscate leverage. Their job is to leverage until all of a sudden everything explodes. Because until everything explodes, they're making more money off of leveraging more. And when everything explodes, it's like, oops, looks like the economy screwed me. I'll have to get a new job. Sorry about your deposits. And this experiment of letting banks run rampant and do whatever they feel like doing was done in the 1800s. And you had financial crises of the scale of what happened in 2008, 2009, but in many cases worse, just happened every 10, 15 years. And it was decided that this was a bad thing, and regulations were put in place that there were limits on what banks could do, and regulations on it that put limits on who can be a banker and what hoops you have to jump through to do that. And the problem is when you loosen up these regulations, you don't get technologists coming in and building new stuff. I mean, eventually you get that a little bit, but the people who really jump into things are scam artists. They'll hop on that immediately, like just go. They'll take everybody's money. And so there are good reasons why there are limits on just what you can do in banking and why you can't just go build something better. Now, the bad reason is that there's regulatory capture. The people who are considered trustworthy really like things being the way they are. They like these slow, inefficient systems. They themselves are not experts in how to build new technology and build things better. They want to sit on it and leave it exactly the way it is today. The problem with making a better banking system is the problem is not how do you build something better. Like any minimally competent technologist can build something better. The problem is how do you get that deployed in the real world? And in order to do that, you need to eliminate the trusted third party. In order to eliminate the trusted third party, you need a secure distributed database. And like I started with, Bitcoin is a secure distributed database. It's like this first idea of how on earth do we make a secure distributed database? And that has the promise of really making money transmission and remittances and all this money stuff actually work well, be based on real tech where money moves quickly, it moves securely with end user control and transparently and all that good stuff. And that's what's really exciting about it. But that's not what the vast majority of people in this space are going after. The vast majority of people in the space are following a get-rich-quick scheme. Most of them don't know what Bitcoin is. Most of them haven't the foggiest clue what the underlying technology does. Most of them just know at some point, if you had bought Bitcoin, whatever that means, it went up in value by a lot and you'd have gotten rich. That's what people know.
Right.
And I think that's getting into it for the wrong reasons.
So are we now in the September that never ended for crypto? Like, is it just overrun with jerks?
You know, the crypto space is interesting because it attracted a lot of the people who are in the crypto space have been there for a while and they got attracted to it for all kinds of reasons. And it has resulted in all these really interesting characters being there. And so I'm used to this from I've been around cypherpunks for a long time. And at least, you know, like Bitcoin core devs are considerably less weird than cypherpunks as a whole used to be. And just because there's a real project to work on there that adds this kind of focus and commonality and sanity check. But there are definitely people who are, you know, outright scam artists, including in Bitcoin, who, you know, claim that they were Satoshi, you know, claim to have made a ridiculous amount of money that they probably didn't, and claim to be this great visionary who's the one to lead the world forward, and that everything should hard fork, and so the way they think everything should work. You know, and then that's not even counting the altcoins that are just outright scams. And some of these are just farcical. So they're just ridiculous. They're just, they'd be funny if, you know, the government of England wasn't asking the people who did it for advice on how to regulate cryptocurrencies, because they think these people know what they're talking about, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's horrifying.
Yeah.
I guess what would you say keeps you up at night when you look either to the current frothy space that crypto is today, or when you look ahead, I guess, what do you see coming at us?
Oh, in terms of disasters that could befall everyone, there's a very easy path to point to in Bitcoin, that you have the block rewards are going down over time, right? They get halved every 4 years. So, and that means, you know, in 40 years from now, they'll be 1/1000th what they are today.
In case you have no idea what halving is, remember when we touched on Bitcoin mining, where all those computers were doing all that math? If you were wondering why anyone would invest time and money doing that, it's because they get paid rewards in Bitcoin for it. But the amount they're paid gets cut in half every 4 years for reasons that aren't relevant to this conversation.
In Bitcoin, the plan is for that halvings to just kind of stop. Or no, it's for having to keep going, and then block rewards just kind of stop. And it's a long way off before they literally hit zero, but they become effectively zero long, long before that. And then all that's left are transaction fees. So it's possible that transaction fees will still be quite low then, and transaction fees are low now, in a tremendous victory for market forces at work. Transaction fees were high, and then all the core devs were like, we're going to sit on our hands. We're going to wait for people to fix their shit so they're not creating more transactions than they have to. And so you see this pattern today that in Bitcoin, where there are meaningful transaction fees during the day, and then they go to zero at night. Now, in some ways, this is pretty good, because everything does eventually clear. You know, you can get things in cheap if you want to. If you're more care about, if you're time sensitive during the day, you can pay for that. This is totally reasonable. What happens when block rewards cease to be meaningful, and all you're really left with is transaction fees? If, and this is a big if, transaction fees are high enough for this whole thing to be sustainable, you can easily run into a situation where it works the way it does today, where you have meaningful transaction fees during the day and none overnight. And then what winds up happening is miners just reorg overnight. Like they do a certain amount of mining during the day, and then they spend the entire night redoing the mining that they did during the day to steal the transaction fees from each other, and then restart doing it properly again the next morning. And this would be a disaster. It would just be utter chaos. And the incentives are likely to be for this behavior in the not that distant future. So yeah, this could be a real disaster for Bitcoin. Not in Chia. In Chia, we have three halvings is the current plan, and then it stops going down because this gets sketchy. For Chia, you know, the things that keep me up at night about Chia are really our consensus algorithm. I've obsessed with it a lot. I continue to obsess with it. I just spent several months on our proof of space. I'm continuing to spend time on our proof of space. These are, you know, really new mathematical primitives that I think we have a good handle on, but until they're out there and being used and have a long track record on them, I'm going to continue obsessing and fretting and worrying and doing everything in my power to make sure that they don't die horribly.
And I guess, what would you say are you maybe most excited about? Does this come back to the efficiency in sort of monetary transactions and smart transactions?
You know, when I think about the future, I don't think about what I'm excited about. I think about what I'm terrified about, and I am heads down full time trying to avoid the things that I'm terrified of. And I hope that if I succeed in not failing for long enough, I will actually succeed. But I'm not focused on the success. I'm focused on the failure.
And the failure is sort of the world drifting along its sort of current trajectory with incredible inefficiency, especially around our financial institutions.
The status quo is a form of failure. A worse form of failure is moving the world off of the status quo and then having that collapse. And then you're left with nothing.
Got it. Like if every human being all of a sudden traded in all their dollars for some altcoin that had zero, you know, technical integrity behind it, and we just found ourselves holding a bunch of meaningless hardware.
Yes, that would be.
I see.
that would be cryptocurrencies having set the world back. And given the amount of speculation and the amount of losses that have happened in cryptocurrencies, it's a really, you know, unclear question of whether the existence of cryptocurrencies to date has been a net positive for humanity. I think cryptocurrencies have yet to make a compelling case that they're really making the world better. I think there's a way they can. I think they could really enable and improve commerce tremendously, but I think they're very, very far away from having proven that yet.
Is there a picture that you could paint around the future if this revolution that will be free sort of comes to pass?
The way you know that cryptocurrencies are succeeding is when they're enabling commerce. If you succeed in making commerce happen, then prices will naturally go up because you're creating value, and that is the correct and righteous way of the world. And speculation-based things are unimportant and tangential. And they're today enabling some commerce. You definitely have people who are stuck in like Venezuela or Iran or whatever who just need to send money around, who just can't do it. And they're using Bitcoin to do that because it's the only option. Now, to what extent that's happening, it's unclear. It's sort of guesswork. That actual usage of Bitcoin is putting some kind of a floor on its price, probably a much lower floor than where it is today. There's probably still a huge amount of speculation baked into Bitcoin's current price, and it could go down. It could go up, but it could also go down. I don't think there's really any meaningful floor under basically all the cryptocurrencies other than Bitcoin, with the possible exceptions of like Monero and Zcash have their own niche. But the way you know you're succeeding is not that the value of a cryptocurrency went up. The way you know it's succeeding is that real commerce is getting enabled and happening with it. And what we're likely to see is it starts with the big high value payments that you start seeing, like interbank and just large value transactions being done that you're settling on using cryptocurrencies, and it gradually works its way down until the point where you basically have like a bank account that's enumerated in like Chia, and this is something that you have far more control over, that's really under your control, that is transparent about what all the policies are, that you can set what they are, that has all the, you know, the blockchain security guarantees on it, and which has many fewer middlemen in the way because of this miraculous technical dodge around needing a trusted third party to actually do your commerce. You probably will have a bank or something like a bank that you have these parties who are kind of helping you with net settlement and who are the ones you go to if you lose your king materials and like help you unhack yourself if you get hacked. Things like that. But there will be a delayering of the different services banks are providing to you, where they're really kind of providing you actual services in an actually competitive way rather than mostly just being these middlemen who sit in the way of clearing and you have to use a bank because that's the only way you can get clearing.
Did creating BitTorrent and now working on Chia change your perspective on the internet in any way?
I don't know. I mean, the internet has become so integral to everyone's lives. I think the big shift is there were all these ways that geeks acted, that they were obsessed with their work, with their computers, that they had all this drama with people that they primarily knew online. And it was generally considered that this was a sign that they were maladjusted weirdos,
And now that everyone has computers and internet access, it turns out they weren't really any different than anyone else. They just had computers and internet access before everyone else did. Mm-hmm. And everyone, like, everybody acts like computer-obsessed weirdos who have high drama with people they don't really know except online when they have access to computers. That's the way humans are. I think there's this responsibility of people who can build technology to prioritize things that do the world good, right? Make things that, you know, move data from point A to point B with good integrity, right? I view this as a highly ethical thing to work on. Make things that help people communicate better, you know, communicate at lower latency, not forget things, stay in touch with their friends. Don't build malware, right?
Right.
Like, don't like collect people's information to sell to Russian intelligence, you know, like kind of common sense things like that. But I've always felt that way. And I've felt other people think differently about some things that I've done. But I've always felt that I've really strongly prioritized things that really clearly did some good for the world.
This has been the Internet 3.0. I'm your host, Zach Valenti. You can learn more about Chia at chia.net. If you like the show, please consider subscribing and leaving a top rating and review wherever you listen. We'd also love to know what you think about this episode on Twitter. Bram Cohen is at Bram Cohen, Manib Ali is at Manib, and I'm at Zach Valenti. Please let me know who you'd like to be featured on the Internet 3.0. Music in this episode is by Andrew Apple Pie. Hear more at andrewapplepie.com. You can find out more about the show at internet3podcast.com. And if you're interested in the future of decentralized apps, you can learn more at blockstack.org. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to check out our other episodes featuring Brendan Eich and Albert Wenger, available wherever you listen to podcasts.